This is Frank Sesich of Blue Ash, and you're listening to 90.7 FM, WGXC, Accra.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
Wayfarm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wayfarm and our radio station, WGXC, operate and broadcast. The Mohicans named themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Mohicanituck, the Great Ebbtide River, also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For further information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit Mohican.com.
Wayfarm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of SJ of Great Barrington, Massachusetts. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Raymond Pagnone reports for Columbia Green Media that Greene County's legislature voted on October 18th to spend $100,000 in American Rescue Plan Act funds on an Exit 21 development project that originally cost $2,139,000. The Greene County Industrial Development Agency plan is to add a Hampton Inn Hotel to a tourism center, steward shop, and another unknown business next to the I-87 highway entrance in Leeds. Already, the former Greene County Tourism Center has been demolished, and the steward shop will move into its new building as soon as the company removes the store's underground gasoline storage tanks and gas islands at its former location across the stream. Greene County Administrator Sean Groden has hopes for a restaurant to go next to the hotel. Groden said, and I quote, "Most likely the hotel developers will be instrumental in landing a restaurant deal because as they're building the hotel, they'll want a companion piece. It will most likely be a franchise. At that location, you probably want a national name. That's not to say if someone local wanted to build there, they couldn't," end quote. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. Mid-Hudson News reports that Cook Political Report is forecasting that the congressional elections in New York's 17th and 19th congressional districts as, and I quote, "toss-ups," end quote. Republicans Mike Lawler and Mark Molinaro unseated incumbent Democrats in 2022 in those districts, helping to give the GOP a 5-seat majority. The Cook Political Report is also saying that Democrat Pat Ryan's 18th congressional district, and I quote, "leans Democrat," end quote. So far, each of the three incumbent candidates has at least one opponent. Attorney Josh Riley, a Democrat, is running again after losing to Molinaro in 2022. Democrat Mondaire Jones is challenging Lawler, and Republican Allison Esposito wants to unseat Ryan. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. Mid-Hudson News reports that Bard College is getting $69,886 from the Hudson River Foundation for Science and Environmental Research, Incorporated, a New York not-for-profit, for a 2-year project to update and improve water quality data sets. Elias Duker, Associate Professor of Environmental and Urban Studies, and Gabriel Perrone, Associate Professor of Biology, are analyzing microbiological micropollution samples and comparing those results with historical water quality data from the Sawkill Tributary from the mid-70s to early 80s and from 2015 to present. Duker said, and I quote, "This partnership with Hudson River Foundation allows the Bard Center for Environmental Science and Humanities to strengthen its commitment to using science as a tool for environmental and social change. We hope this unique effort to utilize and elevate community-fueled science will serve as a model for contemporary and meaningful approaches to creating climate-resilient communities in the Hudson Valley." End quote. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day. And a pleasant tomorrow.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
Everybody, get in line. Nothing can come between us. Nothing gets you down. Nothing strikes your fancy.
We have from Cornell Cooperative Extension right now, live in the studio at Wave Farm, Devin Connolly. Welcome to the Monday afternoon show. Cornell Cooperative Extension doing wonderful events, workshops, educational matters, studies, and whatnot. We had a sit-in for you. Was it the last session? You weren't able to make it, so we had a wonderful guest that sat in for you, and her name is slipping my mind right now. Who was that, Devin?
It was her name is Lindsay. I have to admit, I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Give me one second.
I got the last name pronunciation. I remember I finally law something had to do stress law.
What's a hyphenated name? One second.
It's L-A-U is pronounced.
Oh, God,
law.
Lindsay.
Law? I just remember.
Straw law hallway?
Law. Straylaw.
Straylaw.
Yeah, Straylaw.
All right, Lindsay's going to absolutely be giving me hell tomorrow.
Well, she's going to hate me, too, because how dare I, you know, forget. So sorry, Lindsay. Lindsay Straylaw, she talked about chainsaw safety, women's chainsaw workshops that was happening in ACRA, the forestry walks, talking about climate resiliency, and all sorts of other good stuff in your absence. We had a nice little chat here on the air, and really great to have somebody, even though you couldn't make it. But here you are today. Devin, how's it going? What's going on at Cornell? What's the good news?
All right. We'll start out with the next class we have coming up in November. We've been having this program. That's a three-part program called Think Differently Columbia. I don't know if you've heard of the Think Differently program before. It's about supporting folks and educating folks who are, you know, have or are caretaking folks with autism. We had a first class on October 2nd, which was supporting individuals with autism, training for parents and caregivers. We continue that series with our next course. It will be Monday, November 6th, 5:30 to 7. It's called Help, Why Does My Child Keep Doing That? This will be in Hudson at the Extension Education Center. This training provides parents, caregivers with a new perspective on their child's challenging behavior. Though understanding the context and motivation behind challenging behavior, parents will be able to make better informed decisions on how to support their child. Basic strategies for improving behavior will be learned. So there's a one-hour program followed by half an hour informal discussion. Light refreshments are served. This program is completely accessible. Just go to our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org/events and sign up. And if you know anyone who could use this sort of training in their life, you know, absolutely tell them.
I think it might be close to like 40% of parents right now, or at least the numbers are getting up there staggeringly. I've been in the field of education just a little bit. I did some farming and gardening teaching, and we're just seeing different needs, like special needs is one term, but like just I feel like almost every single child right now coming into this world and growing up as a young child is like in need of some special care in one way or another. And it's just the fact and fact of our times right now where children definitely are saying something to us. So sorry to go off on that, but that's an issue dear to my heart. So again, Devin, could you give us the time and place again for that workshop?
Yep. So this will be Help, Why Does My Child Keep Doing That? It'll be Monday, November 6th, 5:30 to 7 in Hudson at our office at the Extension Education Center. Sign up at our website, ccecolumbiagreen.org/events.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. Next thing we'll have be coming up is our... I'm not going to talk about that, right?
No, you can talk about your fundraiser.
Yep. We have our annual fundraiser. It's called the Taste of Twin Counties Fundraiser. That'll be on Wednesday, November 8th. If you like what I've been talking about on the radio show, or if you've been to one of our classes, or have used one of our educators, please come support. This is one of the most impactful way to say thank you to us. This will be at Liberty Farms in Ghent on Wednesday, November 8th from 5:30 to 7:30. It's not super long, but there will be a, you know, Taste New York inspired charcuterie table. There'll be some local desserts being served, a silent auction, tons of people that if you like what we're doing, you'll like seeing them there as well. Our board and our staff, or, you know, much of our staff will be available to talk to. I think it's going to be a lot of fun if you guys can make it. Go find your tickets online. Again, going to plug the website, ccecolumbiagreen.org/events. We'd love to see you there.
Some partay.
Absolutely. I don't know if you've been to the Liberty, the barn at Liberty Farms in Ghent, but it is a nice space to hang out.
That's what I've heard. I've not been there, Devin, but I've heard that Liberty Farms, up, that's right off of Route 66, I believe, mm-hmm. up there in Ghent. And Polly Vaughn Deramo some years ago was doing a lot of work up there. I don't know if he's there anymore, but he's an old friend of mine. His father ran the healing plant herb garden at Copay. And I heard just awesome things about Liberty Farms. So I can't wait to go check it out myself. Maybe even be there for November 8th for your fundraiser tasting.
Mm-hmm. Hope to see you there. Next on the list, so this one is a class that is available to our master gardeners and will potentially be open to the public, so I just wanted to mention it. It's called Sustainable Landscapes Pollinator Restoration with Integrated Pest Management. This will be on Friday, November 17th, 9:30 to 12:30. You can join Christopher Williams from the Capital Region Partnership for Regional Invasive Species Management. So PRISM is actually what the acronym for that is. Join Chris for a presentation workshop on how to apply conservation-based practices on a small scale to provide ecosystem benefits within your yard or woodlot. This program will outline the various forms of integrated pest management that can be applied to control invasive species. So again, this is going to be a program for our master gardeners, but there is a pretty good chance that we will open this up to the public. So keep an eye on our website just to make if this sounds interesting to you. And especially if you're an aspiring master gardener, this could potentially be a good class for you to take. It'll all be online probably the next couple weeks before the class. That's November 17th. What's 2 weeks before then, at least? You have a calendar on you, Kieran. So, yeah, by November 3rd.
Okay. Okay, that's a really important one too. Integrated pest management, aka IPM. If you go buy fruit or apples or something in the market, you might see IPM as opposed to organic. And what that is using insects against insects,
mm-hmm.
using like parasitic wasps and other kinds of insects that eat the bad insects that destroy the fruit crops. And it's a very important way of working with nature in an agricultural way to mitigate the issues of insect damage to fruit, which New York State is a major producer of fruit, especially apples, as you folks probably know. So IPM, super important, Devin. Thank you.
Yep. And finally, the last program that we'll be having, not a course, but still something I think will be sort of special. We have art showings, and we have a gallery in our acre office at the Agroforestry Resource Center. And this one is not going to be adults. We're actually introducing our 4-H'ers for the first time ever. We're going to have an art show opening for them on Saturday, November 18th from 3 to 5 p.m. Our local 4-H artists will have a display of work they have created in various mediums. The artworks will be available for purchase, 90% of the purchase going back to the artist, 10% going to the 4-H as a fundraiser. And if anyone can make it, we encourage you to stop by anytime during the opening. Light refreshments will be available. Again, this is completely accessible, and you don't even need to register for this. Just show up on November 18th.
Art. You guys are getting into the art world now too. I love it.
Yeah. that's it. That's all the programs that I have that for the coming month.
Okay, so it sounds like you got a great, healthy, packed November full of fun and activities. I think that helps folks put it in their calendar. Let's go.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else, Devin? Anything from Cornell Cooperative Extension? We got the website CCEColumbiaGreen.org. You guys can go on there, and a lot of information there as well.
Yeah, feel free to browse our resources, find a staff member who you might want to talk to, see those events. Always encourage you to go to the website.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
There are a few relevant military officers with experience, the kinds of experience that we believe is appropriate to sorts of operations that Israel is conducting and may conduct in the future.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says the White House has authorized military officers to travel to Israel and to share their perspectives. Israel has delayed expected ground operations in Gaza, but still seems poised. The death toll continues to rise. More than 1,400 Israelis and 5,000 Palestinians have been killed. Michigan progressive Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib is calling on President Joe Biden to seek a ceasefire.
President Biden, not all of America's with you on this one. And you need to wake up and understand that.
During a tech event Monday, Biden said he would be willing to consider a ceasefire if Hamas releases the 200 hostages it holds. More than 10 Americans still remain unaccounted for. House Republicans have scheduled a vote on their next speaker nominee today, although that timing may slip. Former Florida Republican Representative David Jolly told MSNBC that Majority Whip Tom Emmer of Minnesota is the likely frontrunner.
Tom Emmer would be the natural pick in a moment where everything has collapsed and you just reach for a consensus candidate.
Emmer does face opposition from former President Donald Trump, but it's far from clear how important that is. The House is heading into a third week without a speaker after two nominees failed to get the near-perfect GOP support they would need. One of the nine candidates who's closer to the former president, Brian Donald of Florida, says the vote must be member-driven, not based on who wants to advance.
We need to get back to work, secure our border, fund our government responsibly, and hold this administration accountable.
Over the weekend, former Wyoming Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney said she's not ruling out a White House bid. During the interview with CNN, Cheney says she believes Trump is the single most dangerous threat to the country, and she'll work for candidates who'll safeguard democracy.
We don't want a situation where the election is thrown into the House of Representatives and Donald Trump has any possibility at all of prevailing under those circumstances.
Senator Bob Menendez pleaded not guilty to a federal charge that he acted as an unregistered agent of Egypt while serving as chair of Senate Foreign Relations. Menendez had a brief interaction with reporters going into court Monday.
How are you feeling today?
Will you make a statement?
How are you feeling today? Good?
I'm all right. Okay.
This is Menendez's second not guilty plea in a month. He and his wife are accused of extensive corruption. Finally, the United Auto Workers are expanding their six-week strike, calling on nearly 7,000 members to walk out of a Detroit Stellantis plant. The UAW accuses Stellantis of falling short compared to proposals from Ford and General Motors. I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. October 19th, the North Carolina Senate Redistricting Committee presented its latest congressional redistricting maps. After 3 years of wrangling, including two state Supreme Court cases and a U.S. Supreme Court case, it's now more gerrymandered than its original 2021 map. When conservatives took control of the North Carolina Supreme Court this spring, they immediately overturned decisions made by the previous court, which threw out the 2021 proposal as unconstitutional and ordered a more competitive map. That map had six Democratic-leaning seats, seven Republican-leaning seats, and one highly competitive seat. Conservatives argued they should have had a 9-5 GOP advantage. That map was challenged in the U.S. Supreme Court's Moore v. Harper, the independent state legislature case. Justices shot down the fringe ISL theory, but the state court later vacated the competitive map, leaving it again to a legislature drunk on partisan power to draw the maps. Last week, two new gerrymandered proposals abandoned any pretense of competitive districts. Analysis by WFAE Public Radio shows one version packing Republicans into 11 districts and Democrats into 3, and in the second, packing Republicans into 10 districts, Democrats into 3, and one toss-up. Whichever map is chosen, it's likely to face a court challenge, but pending a decision, it may be in place for the 2024 election. We have links to the maps and analysis at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Rosemary Reyes is on the line waiting. We're just going to make this happen. Rosemary, can you hear me by some magic?
I can, yes.
No way. So magic does happen. And right now, this is evidence. So, Rosemary Reyes, welcome to, am I saying that last name right, Reyes?
Yes, that's right, Reyes.
Reyes. Rosemary Reyes, thank you for joining us on the Monday Afternoon Show. Welcome. So nice to have you with us. How's it going?
It's lovely. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I was so excited to get this interview especially when I heard Light Forms Art Center in Hudson, when that place opened, it was pretty exciting. I think it was just before COVID, and Laura Summer joined me in the studio to talk about Light Forms and all the good stuff that was happening down there. So it sounds like you have something coming up at Light Forms Art Center. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So actually my show, it's a solo exhibition. It opened on October 7th and it closes on the 28th, which is Saturday. And it's a show of large scale collages that I've made and a few ceramic pieces and a painting. And the theme of the show is water. So the title it's called All I See is Water. And the water element has been my muse for the show. And it's been such a wonderful month, just hosting different events and activations in the space, workshops and dance parties, and really wonderful ways of getting people to see the work.
Heck yeah. So I'm looking right now. You can go to Light Forms Art Center. All I See is Water is the exhibit. It's already started. It's in full force right now. It started on October 7th. And I'm seeing dance parties, medicine, elixir making workshops that happen, performances, collage making. Loki was in on it. He's been on the show, I think, before, a long time ago. So you're really actually doing more than just presenting an art form. You're actually community engagement, doing activities. So you're into the dance parties too. So tell us, like, just what's been going?
Yeah. So it's, I think, you know, I actually started a lot of my art making practice around organizing. I was living in New Orleans about 10 years ago, and started making collages as flyers for dance parties. And then I began to DJ, and holding space and gathering people has always been a big source of joy for me. And I've always felt really rooted in my purpose in gatherings and organizing celebration. So beyond just, you know, being a visual artist, gathering people around the work and talking about healing together and envisioning a peaceful futures, and, you know, especially right now with so many horrific things happening on the planet, it feels really important to gather and in celebration. And I don't know, that's kind of my attempt at turning the traditional ways of exhibiting art on its head a little bit. I think gallery environments can be a little bit intimidating. And Light Forms does such a wonderful job at really making it community-based efforts there, and just having it be a space that really welcomes folks to participate in art in ways that are really, I would say, more expansive than the more traditional ways.
I love it. I mean, when Laura Summer started talking about part of the ideals and values behind Lightforms Art Center is just like art dispersal, to make art accessible and free to people, but free in a way that is part of like a participatory, like interchange of just experiencing each other's like artistic abilities and just encouraging people to get involved. People like me who I'm like, I don't know if I'm going to go to a gallery, drink some wine, eat some cheese, and look at like $8 billion art that I can't afford. And I don't know, I thought about crashing like art gallery openings before, just fun to have some wine and cheese and like make up big words about like a stupid painting that's $6 million. Like this is totally different. Like Hudson's doing it right. I love what you guys are doing over there. And just, when I got the flyer here, all I see is water. I'm just over the border from you in Housatonic, Massachusetts, where we have a major public water crisis. Our public water supply, which is privately owned by a private company, has been totally awful. And I particularly have been, of course, following, you know, all sorts of issues in the world, such as, you know, like the Dakota Access Pipeline, like indigenous resistance to pipelines going through the communities, and the issue of water as life, Mini Wachoni. Like, tell me, talk to us a little bit how you came to this exhibit, how your relationship, what's your relationship to water? just tell us a little bit about how you came to this.
Yeah. So a bit about my background. I last year completed the first 7-year cycle of a shamanic apprenticeship. So I'm really coming at my art making from the lens of a healer. So, you know, while a lot of my peers were getting MFAs, I was in shaman school. And so the elements are such a central part to medicine making and healing, but also working across the veil, which is what shamans do. They're kind of the bridge between the material realm and the unseen realm, and engage energies that are often unseen in order to bring healing to the material realm. So that as a point of reference for my interest as an artist and my mission as an artist. Water was kind of an obvious entry point. You know, I also moved up to the Hudson Valley about almost 4 years ago now. And in moving up here and being so close to the river, I engaged the river by bringing offerings every day. I swam in the water in a pond near my house every day. I started to like go on hikes to visit all the waterfalls in the area, Bashbish, Cotterskill, High Falls, and went to the Caribbean to surf last winter. So really engaging water in a way of, you know, play, in ceremony, and then also understanding it as something that is so central and vital and sacred to us as humans. And yeah, so it really became my muse. In a way that I didn't really even realize it was happening until I started to think thematically about what I wanted to focus to show on. And then I was like, oh yeah, I've been apprenticing the water in such a deep way through my apprenticeship, but also in living in this region where there's so many beautiful access points. And yeah, it is such a precious resource. So to bring light to how the climate is shifting and how, you know, the oceans are shifting and how all of the sea life is shifting, you know, you can go on and on about this topic. It's such a huge topic, but that's kind of scratching the surface on my inspiration around the theme.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge question, a huge theme, and you did scratch the surface, but wonderfully so there. And I love how you picked this, and shared with us that you're on this journey beyond just like visual art and collage and sharing with people. You're actually on this deeper spiritual journey of the shamanic practice, and it would make sense that water is a big part of that. I mean, we're 75% water or something like that, or more, and then the entire world, the entire earth is 75% water. I mean, it's all about the water in my opinion. So that's just beautiful how you describe that. Can you tell me a little bit about the collage, your collage stuff? Very curious about that. Been really wanting to engage in collage experiences, and you had a workshop on collages. I'm sorry I missed it. But tell me a little bit about that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, totally. So the inspiration for the material was of one of my earliest childhood memories, which I went to elementary school in New York City and Washington Heights. And, you know, in the early 90s, I don't know if they still do this, but one of the ways that they would test, that you would test into the school system in New York, was they would give you a piece of manila paper, and to test your motor skills, you had to cut the outline of a star. And, you know, I have this really, really vivid childhood memory of like holding these really dull safety scissors and really struggling to cut through the thicker kind of construction paper. And in the form of a star, it just felt so challenging. And that memory was really became kind of the drive for this compulsion that I have, which is like to create these like wild forms that come through when I'm channeling or engaging with my spirit guides, and cut in the most intricate ways possible, and like develop my skill in cutting in the most intricate ways possible to try to kind of recapture that memory in a way that is more playful and I have more sovereignty over. And so that's kind of a large part of why paper and why collage. I think collage is also such a beautiful way of kind of piecing together all of these different experiences and materializing that and making something really beautiful and interesting out of it. And so, yeah, that's a large part of my inspiration on why collage. But, you know, I think at my truest heart, I'm a mixed media artist. I love kind of mixing paint and mixing different materials to see what happens. And I'm kind of deepening in that process. But the collage really just felt like one of the most accessible ways to really hone my artistic freedom. Given that really, really kind of cellular memory of entering this institutional way of being, right, for the first time, which is the education system.
Yeah, God, I had never heard of that manila star cutting practice. That's very interesting to me. And the fact that it's it's kind of neat though, in a weird way, that it's the shape of a star that the institutional, educational, whatever, whoever decided, a star. I mean, that's a sacred shape.
Definitely. Yeah. And you know, I hadn't even thought about that. And the star really only shows up once in the show. And somebody actually asked me yesterday, was like, why is there a star there? And now I'm like, oh, obviously, because that's the whole impetus for why I did this. But yeah, the star as a symbol is you can really go deep, deep, deep into that too.
Yeah, and the fact that they're judging you on how well you cut it out. And I'm just going to assume here that they're looking at how perfectly and dimensional and accurate the child cuts out the star.
Yeah. I think that's what it was. Yeah. Right. To kind of test your motor skills. Yeah.
So like what the heck, because that like throws all of our humanity out the window, down the bathtub, however you want to term it, because like the whole point of art is to express the feeling. And like, I don't know, the star to me, the star, when you see the word star, the word, I don't know, it's just like not a perfect cookie cutter cut out. I'm thinking of snowflakes where everyone is different.
Right.
So, wow. So that's awesome. So that's awesome. You got that inspiration. You went way back to Washington Heights for that one.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. And how did you find your way up to Hudson again?
So I moved up here pretty shortly after the pandemic started. I was living in Brooklyn, and I'd been wanting to leave the city for many years at that point. And like many people who kind of migrated north during the pandemic, it was like that catalyst that kind of gave me permission to leave my city life. And I'm so grateful. Just being in the natural world has been so, so wonderful. And again, generative for my practice, evidently. So.
Well, hey, if you've been to Catterskill and Bash Bish, like, unfortunately, the city is great. I love the city for so many different things and for culture and for going down there and just getting the experience of just the sheer diversity and the human craziness that is the city. But my favorite part about the city is coming back home. And like you've witnessed these waterfalls that they just don't have down there. Bash Bish, you know, if you look up, there's crazy that big rock at the top, it's called the J Rock. It's kind of shaped like a J. And I've jumped off of that when I was 18 years old. I jumped off the J Rock into a tiny pool of water. Yeah, it's just. The words don't describe that experience with growing up or being around like what we have, these water features, water around us. So I just love that you're doing this exhibit on water, and you still have a couple more events coming up. I should say that the day after tomorrow, on Wednesday, October 25th, you have squiggly candle making happening. Alicia Mazzella, is that still happening?
It is still happening. The workshop is full. So if you haven't already signed up, it is capped, just because it is, you know, we're going to be making candles. So there's a specific number of people that it was a limited workshop. The squiggles is kind of a reference to the forms in my work. And I think it's also just a playful way of inciting movement to the eye. And, you know, again, going back to childhood memories of art making, right? Like the squiggle is one of the ways that we learn to denote movement, or if something is smelly, we'll draw a squiggle. If something is cold, right, we'll draw a squiggle. If something is hot, we'll draw a squiggle. So it's really how we incite life in illustration. So I wanted to kind of have that be a thread through the events visually. And then on Saturday is the closing, which is open to anyone who wants to come. And it's at 8 p.m. until probably just before midnight. We'll probably be wrapping up. And it'll be a dance party. A good friend of mine who goes by Afro Anarchy, they're an amazing DJ. And they've been preparing this beautiful 3-hour set that we are going to be dancing to. And we'll have a beautiful ancestral altar built. And yeah, it'll be, you know, costumes encouraged if folks wanna come through in their looks, in their seasonal looks, they're welcome to. And then the gallery is open on Friday from 3 to 7 as well. So there are definitely still opportunities to see the work and to pop in.
This sounds awesome. So that's this Saturday. That's October 28th, 8 p.m. until late Afro-Anarchy will be holding it down on the DJ front. I assume people will be getting down on the dance floor.
Absolutely. That's the hope.
That's great. And it's an important celebration, Dia de los Muertos. It's, you know, it's the Halloween season, the Day of the Dead. In the Christian tradition, it also, in the next following 2 days, it's All Souls Day and All Saints Day. Mm-hmm. But this is, you were talking about the veils between the spiritual world and the human reality. And this was supposedly in the ancient pagan traditions that the veils between the spirit world and the human world were thin on October 31st, Dia de los Muertos, in which the spirits roaming could actually commune closer with their human counterparts. And it's a pretty awesome time of year. Of course, we have trick-or-treaters and all sorts of Halloween shenanigans, but it sounds like you'll be doing it right over there at Lightform.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's a very sacred time of year, like you said, and it feels like an important time to kind of honor those who came before us and celebrate their lives and celebrate the freedom that we have because of them.
Speaking with Dr. Sandra Steingraber, who's a senior scientist at the Science and Environmental Health Network. And recently, Dr. Steingraber was involved in releasing a new compilation of studies about the dangers of fracking. New York, of course, technically, banned fracking, I think, in 2015. But as we get a lot of frack gas still coming into the state. So, Dr. Steingraber, welcome, and maybe just a brief introduction as to what was this report about and what were the groups behind it?
Yeah, hi, Mark. Pleasure to talk with you today. I am the senior scientist at the Science and Environmental Health Network, and more specifically within that project is a program called Concerned Health Professionals of New York, of which I'm a co-founder. And the sort of origin story here is that we began as a group of scientists and health professionals 10 years ago when our previous governor was trying to decide whether to prohibit or permit fracking. And we set to work compiling the risks and harms of fracking in the peer-reviewed scientific literature so that our elected officials in the governor's office could see an independent compilation of the data, but also so that people in the Southern Tier and other places that were going to get fracked first would know exactly what risks and harms they were being asked to, who were being compelled to kind of bear. And we were pleased that our research findings aligned completely with the group of health professionals that the governor himself had put together. So we reached identical conclusions. And on that basis, as most New Yorkers will remember, I think in December 2014, fracking was banned. But now we've continued with that compendium project. It's now its ninth edition. And my message today is that New Yorkers are really not protected yet from the dangers of fracking because even though we don't frack in New York, the terminus of the fracking pipeline, which starts in the shale fields of Pennsylvania somewhere, it ends up in our homes, right? In our kitchens, even, where we turn on the gas in our gas stoves, where the whoosh of our furnace kicks on and so on. And so we're looking at the health risk created by the indoor air pollution from combusting fracked gas inside of our homes.
And people may remember it was a big fight in the Sheridan Hollow neighborhood because Governor Cuomo had wanted to add on two new fracked gas turbines at the Sheridan Avenue steam plant to power the state capitol, and a big fight about that, and that was stopped. People still trying to get 100% renewable capital to finally shut down this plant that's been polluting the neighborhood for over a century. But what are some of the problems that the report identifies, you know, with the use of natural gas and people's homes here in New York State?
Well, I'm glad you brought up those other projects because indeed there are health effects and climate effects associated with every stage of the fracking pipeline. And that includes the literal pipelines that crisscross New York and the compressor stations that push that gas through the pipelines. And so there are very important citizen battles over pipelines. And now we have this emerging data showing the harm to people inside their own homes. So the data are very clear that nitrogen dioxide, which is created when natural gas is burned inside your home, reaches levels that are, would be illegal out, if it were in your outdoor air. And nitrogen dioxide is a really interesting air pollutant because it's not actually created by the burning of natural gas. It's not a combustion byproduct per se. It's because the heat of a natural gas flame is so high, it burns the air around it, causing nitrogen and oxygen to combine. That chemical turns out to be not very water soluble, which is bad for us because it means that our nasal passages can't help us, can't protect us. And it goes deep into our lungs where it turns into nitrogen, what turns into nitric acid, which is associated with inflammation, wheezing, and triggers asthma, causes asthma and makes asthma attacks worse. So we know in New York State, we've run the numbers that almost one in every five children who have asthma in New York State, it's attributable to the use of gas stove in the kitchens, and that kids who live in homes with gas stoves have much higher rates of asthma than other kids. And of course, this is an environmental justice issue because in lower income housing, houses are smaller, and often families need to rely on their gas stoves for supplemental heat. So the heating problem that we have in New York and the gas stove problem are not unrelated.
So I understand there is some legislation pending in New York that would address this problem. Could you maybe describe the legislation, and, you know, is the governor and the legislature likely to move on it this session?
Yeah, I mean, I feel really hopeful, and I was very happy that when we released the ninth edition of the compendium in a press conference last week, that several senators and assembly members in Albany stood with us scientists to let the New Yorkers know that, in fact, there is legislation that they're co-sponsoring. And so, for example, the New York Heat Act would help transition us off of fracked gas inside of our homes and provide incentives for electrification. And that that bill has passed the Senate and needs assembly members. So so the co-sponsors of that bill came forward, and I believe that the science that we offer can inform that political process and help it gain some traction.
Now, I understand also one of the problems with natural gas is tied into the leaking of methane, and that methane as a greenhouse gas is actually 82 times more potent, at least short term, the first 20 years than carbon. Is leakage of natural gas a problem in terms of climate in New York still?
Yeah, absolutely. And so methane leaks at every stage of the fracking process. It's just an escape artist. And that means that it leaks inside our homes, even when our gas ovens are turned off, and it leaks into outdoor air. So we focus a lot on gas stoves because in the compendium, because unlike gas furnaces or gas water heaters, for example, there's no requirement in the building codes to vent the emissions to the outdoor air. So they build up inside of our kitchens and create these harms and risks for asthma. But it's important to say, as you point out, that even our gas-fired furnaces and hot water heaters, which do vent to the outside air, that doesn't mean those emissions go away. That just means that nitrogen dioxide, the benzene that is a combustion byproduct from burning natural gas, and then methane itself, is leaked into the outside air, where it contributes to our overall outdoor air pollution, but also contributes not insignificantly to greenhouse gases and the climate crisis. So for all those reasons, you know we have technology to get away from this kind of primitive practice of lighting fossil fuels on fire inside of our own homes. We've got heat pumps. I've got one operating in my house right now. So my house is completely electrified and off of, I'm not burning any fossil fuels inside my home. My air quality is better. I save money on heat. So we just have these technologies that are better, but we need to help incentivize them. We need policies to help the transformation happen.
So in the last minute or so, what can people do at this point, both to, take action in their own homes, but, support statewide policies? And if people want to see this report, is there a website someplace?
Yeah, I mean, science is one part of social change, right? I think that science needs to inform the way forward, but there's no substitute for creating a social movement to compel these changes. The gas industry is very powerful politically and is trying to prevent this transformation. So we all need to get involved in the political process in an informed way. So we have uploaded this compendium, which is a fully referenced, open access, peer-reviewed monograph written in plain English. I did my best not to load it up with a lot of jargon, and it's on our website. You know, the way I find it, I just Google fracking compendium and it pops right up. But our website is concernedhealthny.org.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Sandra Steingraber, senior scientist at Science and Environmental Health Network. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Oh,